Before we start this episode of Conversations with Kenyatta, I'm excited to tell you about my new partnership with Audible. Listeners can go to www.audibletrial.com/Kenyatta to receive a free 30-day trial. Audible is a wonderful resource with audiobooks for every reader. It even has titles from authors that have been on my podcast, such as Dr. Dan Bouck's Democracy's Data and Gail Lukasik's White Like Her. And please note that this is an affiliate link, so I may receive a commission with no cost to you, just a free trial with so many wonderful titles. And I love to read. But with that, here's this week's episode of Conversations with Kenyatta. Today, I would like to welcome Earl Somay and Gregory Crawford from the Library of Virginia. Welcome to Conversations with Kenyatta. So Earl, please introduce yourself and give us some background on your role and how long you've been at the Library of Virginia.
Well, thanks, Kenyatta. My name, as you said, is Earl Somay. I'm director of the Virginia Newspaper Project here at the Library of Virginia in Richmond, Virginia. While we are called the Library of Virginia, it's good to note that we are actually the State Library and Archives for the Commonwealth of Virginia. Truth be told, I began working with the Library of Virginia, I think, around 1993, 94. So it's been a while. I think it was a little after the Reformation, but I've been here quite a while. And so I've been able to help develop the program. Actually, there was no program. I was the first and only project director. And the Virginia Newspaper Project really was born out of the original United States Newspaper Program. And the coolest thing about the United States Newspaper Program was that it was a national effort to catalog and microfilm newspapers. So now we're talking some old school stuff, very analog, pre-digital, find the old newspapers, catalog them, and microfilm them. And by find, I mean not just the Library of Virginia's holdings, but newspapers throughout the state. So literally going into people's attics, going into basements, finding newspapers bound that people were using to shore up their sofas and things like that. So it was really an exciting time in the 90s and early aughts to find the most complete record we could of the newspapers of Virginia. One thing I will note right now, just right off the bat, is that we couldn't find a lot of titles. There's a lot of newspapers that are really gone forever. So unlike certain Western states that were able to sort of cull together almost their entire body of newspaper publishing, we have lost some through time. I've been here since 1993. Virginia newspapers, not to go into a great detail, but newspapers in Virginia began around 1736. So there's hundreds of years of newspapers to search and catalog and microfilm. And yes, today we digitize, which of course is one of the more exciting aspects of newspapers for newspaper researchers. Just want to let you know that I'm a graduate of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and I got my MLS at Columbia University. And that's really it. Prior to coming to Richmond, I got my library degree, and I worked at the New York Public Library and Columbia University in libraries. So, and mostly focusing on library preservation, and now, of course, running the newspaper program here at the Library of Virginia.
So, Greg, please introduce yourself and give us some background on your role and how long you've been at the Library of Virginia.
Okay, my name is Greg Crawford, and my role at the library is I oversee the local records program here at the Library of Virginia. At the heart of the program is a bigger program called the Circuit Court Records Preservation Program. And the CCRP, as we call it, is responsible for assisting circuit courts around the Commonwealth of Virginia with preserving and making accessible the records that are either in their offices or that they have transferred to the Library of Virginia. And these records date back to the 1600s. And the CCRP program, there's two facets to the program. One facet is grants to localities. We provide grants to the localities to assist them with item conservation projects, reformatting projects, storage to better preserve the records that are in their offices. The program began in 1992, 91, 92, Since then, we've given about $25 million in grants to localities. The other facet of the program is localities have the option to transfer the records to the Library of Virginia, where the CCRP provides funding for staff to process, arrange, index, and reformat records that have been transferred here. We have records from pretty much all the localities in Virginia. They range in anywhere from a few volumes from a locality to thousands of boxes of records. And again, these records date back to the 1600s. So there's a lot of history, a lot of narratives, a lot of stories in these records. And one of the things I do is I go and regularly visit the localities. I go to the courthouses to consult with the circuit court clerks about their records. And one of the first things I do when I get there is I go to the drawers of records. There's these old drawers that you just pull out. They're called Woodruff drawers. And there's bundles of old records that are dusty and dirty and filthy in those records, because most folks don't know what those records are or what's in them or what can be found in them. So people typically go to the will books, the deed books, order books, and so forth. But the really good stuff, the really good stories, the history, are found in those bundles. And I regularly tell people when I do presentations on what I do is that when I pull those drawers open, I hear voices in those drawers. I hear people saying, I have a story. People, enslaved people, free people of color, poor, rich, whatever, demographic. They're like, I have a story. You know, I've been in this, cooped up in this drawer for 200 years, and I want somebody to tell my story. So that's what one of the main things we do at the Library of Virginia is we just don't open up the bundles and flatten them and put them in a box and stick them on a shelf. We want people to be able to access those stories. So we try to tell the stories through cataloging, through blogs, through social media, through presentations, to create awareness and share those stories that people, you know, in these bundles have been wanting to have told for centuries. I've been here since 1999, so it's been about 22 years here at the Library of Virginia. And I originally was born in Alabama, born and raised in Alabama. I got a BA and MA in history at Auburn University. My calling has been to come up here to Virginia and work with these records, and I've enjoyed it ever since.
Great. Well, thank you. That program sounds really interesting. And I love the aspect that you mentioned around telling their stories and sharing those stories and people being in the drawers and things like that. And you kind of bringing them to life. And we'll get to that in a minute. But Earl, I want to come back to you. You talked a lot about at the beginning in your intro about the Virginia Newspaper Project and you being one of, I guess, sort of the founding director, we should say, or I would say. But with that project, what type of information can help individuals uncover their family history and build out their family history?
Well, let me start just by giving a little quick background. I think what I really like about what Greg says is it ties in, and we'll probably talk a little more maybe about this later, which is it ties in with what Greg does with what the Newspaper Project does, which is it helps tell stories. And we're always assisting the researchers to use a variety of records, and one of them is newspapers. So the great thing about the project is it starts with humble beginnings with microfilming and cataloging, but then it moves on to digitization. And so that's just a great progression. I mean, it's interesting to note that what Greg and I are talking about, especially my job, is we predate Google. So we go way back. So what we also like to think of is that newspapers serve as the first draft of American history. People say that all the time, but there it is, and it's true. Whether there are rumors, whether there is true news, fake news, it's all there. So what happens is you've got 2,000, 3,000 words on a page. Certainly there is something there for everyone to search and to dig into. It's into your family history or your personal history, or you're doing research on for a PhD, for a book. Newspapers are a wonderful source of information. And one of the real challenges for an institution like the Library of Virginia, which began in 1823, is what it paid attention to and what it ignored. And what it ignored, of course, is the stories that aren't white, if you will. So the African-American story is not properly told. In fact, Greg and I were just talking about this earlier about John Mitchell Jr. in the Richmond Planet. We have John Mitchell Jr., of course, was an African-American editor of the Richmond Planet for 40 years, Black-owned newspaper, and we have almost a complete set of that. And I was wondering, why do we have that? Well, one of the reasons probably is, I think, my theory is that John Mitchell Jr. had the sense to send a gift subscription to the governor. And the governor probably took it and turned it over to the state library. So, we just get lucky sometimes this way. Otherwise, that African-American newspaper could be lost in the mists of time. But now if you add thousands of pages, when you start digitizing and you start adding hundreds of pages, thousands, and now millions of pages to, say, Virginia Chronicle, we have over 1.5 million pages. The opportunity, the potential energy for somebody to find their story, as Greg says, increases immensely. So that's how I like to look at it. You know, it won't get you everything you need, but that's why it's cool to have the newspaper project located at the Library of Virginia, where there are so many other valuable records that could tie you into other sources that could help you tell the story, a fuller story.
Great. Yeah, I love newspapers. It's one of my favorite things as part of my research process, but I also like gossip, so that helps. And newspapers definitely provide us with clues and stories into people's lives and what was going on at that time. But I want to turn it over to Greg and talk about what is Virginia Untold and sort of how has that project evolved over the years?
Well, Virginia Untold is an online digital collection that contains records that tell the story of free and enslaved people. The project began around 2013. For decades, and this is true just not only with the Library of Virginia, but other state archives, the focus has been on records of telling the white experience, of the story of, you know, the founding fathers and the Civil War soldiers and, you know, generals and that experience. But as we were looking at these records, and I started here in 1999, and as I was processing these old bundles of records, I was reading the experiences of African Americans. I was reading the stories of enslaved people seeking freedom. So I was reading stories about how free people had to register. They had to have a piece of paper with them in the 19th century wherever they went to prove that they were free. People were petitioning to stay in Virginia, you know, after they had been emancipated. You know, and around 2013, we were like, we need to tell their story. And so we began to focus in on the collections at the Library of Virginia that would share those stories of enslaved and free people pre-1865. And at first, we focused on documents that just had a lot of names to them. But then we reviewed our collections and we said, well, why don't we focus on the collections that have more narrative to them, that tell more about who these people are? And so we started focusing on collections of records, record types such as freedom suits, where enslaved people could sue for their freedom. There were loopholes in Virginia law that permitted enslaved people to sue for freedom. And there would be narratives in there such as Rachel Finley of Powhatan County, who originally won her freedom around 1780 in Prince George County. But before she got word that she had won her freedom, her enslaver, knowing he was going to lose the money from her, sent her off to Southwest Virginia and had her sold in Southwest Virginia. Rachel never learned that she had won her freedom. She lived in Southwest Virginia for 20 years before she realized she had actually had won her freedom. But she had to file suit all over again to win her freedom. And not only her freedom, but if she wins her freedom, she won the freedom of her children, her grandchildren, and great-grandchildren. And so there was, you read in this court case, these legal records, this narrative of a mother trying to win freedom, not just for herself, but all of her descendants. And then there's records like petitions to remain. In Virginia, there was a law that said that told free people after they are emancipated from slavery, they had to leave the Commonwealth within a year. And so in order to stay, they would file these petitions to remain in Virginia, which gave a lot of background about who they were, who their enslavers were, where they were from. There was also coroner's inquisitions These are like CSI Virginia. These records talk about how people, nobody knows how they died, so they got people to come and do an investigation to determine how someone died. And typically they were enslaved people. People who died from being whipped to death by their enslavers, who were drowned, or these were the tragic stories that were there. And then there, you know, so all these records we identified, and so we focus on processing them, arranging them, indexing them, and then getting them reformatted. And then as a part, then around this time when we started Virginia and Told, our Making History Transcribed project was starting. And Making History Transcribed is a crowdsource site where we put original documents from the 18th, 19th centuries online so that people around the country, around the world, can transcribe these records to make them more accessible and readable. Because I'm sure in your experience, a lot of people have a hard time reading that handwriting from the 18th century, you know, or the 19th century. So by transcribing, by getting experts to people from around the country to do this, we transcribe these records that have made these Virginia Untold stories more accessible to the public. Again, these narratives talk about the Black experience prior to 1866, both enslaved and free. And these narratives have been hidden away for hundreds of years in those drawers that I mentioned earlier. And so we have discovered these narratives. We are making them available. At first, we primarily were looking at local court records. But then we discovered there's a narrative that started in the local court collection that continued in the state records collection. There are records that started in the local records, and you can find them in the governor's records or in legislative petitions that were the General Assembly voted on, or public claims, which are financial records. One of those records in the public claims records in Virginia, an enslaved person who was sentenced to be executed for a crime, that case automatically got appealed to the governor. The governor could review that case and then commute that sentence to be sold out of the state, to be transported to Mississippi, Georgia, or so forth. And so these enslaved people who were convicted, they were brought to Richmond, Virginia, put into state penitentiary. They came from all over Virginia, Northern Virginia, Southern Virginia, Western, wherever. And they were taken to the state penitentiary and sold once a year. And then the slave traders would then take them down to the Deep South. 1,000 enslaved and free people from 1801 to 1865 were sent down south. And the state of Virginia was responsible for the selling of the enslaved people that were in the state pen.
I was going to say, you might want to mention the letters or a letter you've had, the exchange of letters between governors of Virginia and, I believe, Alabama.
Yes.
That's a very telling little correspondence that speaks to what Greg is talking about right now.
Around 1856, the governor of Alabama sent a letter to the governor of Virginia saying, "Why are you sending all these convicted, you know, slaves to my state? You shouldn't be doing that to your fellow southern state. So stop sending them down here." So the governor of Virginia responded with, "We're going to have a law passed that will lessen the amount of enslaved people being sold out of the state. We're going to put them to work on the public works instead in Virginia." So they were going to be hired out to work on the James River Canal, the canal, building railroads, and so forth. The thing about all that is that it shows that the Commonwealth of Virginia was involved in the slave trade, because all this money was coming through the state treasury. When the enslaved people were sold, the state treasury, which is the Auditor of Public Accounts here in Virginia, would take that money to pay off the enslavers for the loss of their property. And whatever profit was over that would remain in the state treasury. These are things that we were finding out, that these stories don't just start in the local records. They continue in the state records, and they continued in the newspapers. We have records that are called runaway slave records. And they relate to the runaway slave ads that are found in Virginia newspapers. I've been working with Errol on that, on trying to, we wanted to come up with a way to connect those, the local records, the runaway slave records, with the newspaper ads. Errol, you can tell them, you want to tell them the story about Joe?
Right. Just very quickly, but it's one of literally hundreds, if not thousands, of stories. And you see these little ads in the paper, in the Richmond Inquirer or the Arlington Gazette, whatever, Virginia newspaper from the antebellum era, and you see these little fugitive slave ads. And you know, it just sort of hit me. I was talking to Greg about this, or I started to. I wanted to mention that. And it's, I mean, maybe it's a trite thing to say, but every ad involves unbelievable risk that a slave, an enslaved person, is willing to basically die rather than continue this period of enslavement. And there, one random example is a slave named John Finney, who was caught and put in a jail in Allegheny County. And he was jailed there. And Greg and I can talk about the details of jailing and the period of time they have to stay in a jail and all that. But the point was, is that John Finney was put in jail in Allegheny County, but he mentioned that his slave master, his enslaver, was in Nottoway County, which means he had already traveled probably by foot well over 100 miles, probably something like 150 miles before being caught and put in jail. And now he's in jail. The jailer is required, I believe, to put post the runaway or fugitive slave ad in two newspapers for a period of a few weeks or months, at which point, if nobody claims that enslaved person, he literally stands him, I think, right outside the jailhouse. The sheriff is there. They put him outside the jailhouse. He's auctioned off. The money is gathered up. A certain amount goes to the jailer to pay for basically, I guess, medical, clothing, room and board. The sheriff gets his cut, and then the remainder of that sale goes to the state. And where it goes is it goes to pay for something called the Literary Fund, which you can see the records of that in the Auditor of Public Accounts in Virginia. And as a matter of fact, the newspapers often had an annual report of the of where that money was distributed by the Auditor of Public Accounts. And what it did is it distributed a certain amount of that money to every county to the Literary Fund, which means basically to help school white children. So John Finney, an enslaved human, is now helping to fund the schooling of some child in Southwest Virginia. And as Greg said, it really brings home the point was that the state was involved in the slave trade, directly involved. They profited from it. They were an integral part of the whole process. And that's just one story. That's just one ad. And that same issue had the Auditor of Public Accounts in it. It had the report for the Auditor of Public Accounts. And it had, I think, a ad for a minister who was going to speak at a local church on various issues related to Christianity. Same page, same issue. So it's all there. And yeah, it's easy for us to, I'm not saying to crack wise, but to shake our heads today, 160 years later. But still, it does bring home the sort of logic or the core values that existed in the antebellum South, and actually in the country before slavery was outlawed through it in the North.
Mm-hmm. And I think you guys both make the point of, you know, the state of Virginia being involved in the domestic slave trade. And a lot of people, you know, from the exchange with sending the, you know, convicted enslaved individuals to Alabama, from the, you know, the runaway enslaved individuals and putting that money into the Literary Fund, right? So a lot of people don't know about that. And I think it's important to show the complexities that surround researching enslaved individuals. Even if you're doing it just for your family history, you need to understand the entire picture. You need to understand what's going on in the state where your ancestor was enslaved. And as everyone knows, and most people say, all roads lead to Virginia anyway. So with that, Greg, can you tell us kind of what new items or what's kind of the future for Virginia Untold? What are some of the exciting things you're working on right now?
The most exciting thing we've happened right now is that we recently received an NHPRC grant. The NHPRC is a federal grant that is given to historical institutions, archives around the United States. We've hired a project manager for Virginia Untold. Up until now, there was no project manager It was just staff here at the Library of Virginia who have a passion for this project. So the NHPRC grant has enabled us to hire a project manager for Virginia Untold. Her name is Lydia Neuroth. And her for the next 2 years, this is a two-year project, she is going to be overseeing and prepping records called Free Negro Registers. And these were registers, volumes that were maintained by the localities. When, as I mentioned earlier, in 1806, Virginia passed a law saying that every enslaved person who was emancipated by either deed, will, after 1806, had to register with their local courthouse. And in return, they would get a document, a certificate that would prove that they were a free person registered in that locality. But clerks also kept a volume keeping track of who were of free persons of color that were registered that day. And so they would start with certificate one and work their way over the next 20 years to certificate number 2000. It would have the name of the free person, their age, their height, any scars on their body, you know, on their hands, on their face, discolorations, mold, a mold on the cheek, or so, anything like that that would give their physical characteristics. And also, they would also would say how they were emancipated, whether they were emancipated by a deed in the name of the enslaver or by a will in the name of the enslaver, or were they born free? So all that information is in these registers, and they're valuable. We have the registers for about 40 localities that are going to go, and as part of this NHPRC project, to be scanned, reformatted, and then they'll be made available on transcribe to be transcribed. And once that's done, once they're transcribed, they will then be uploaded into Virginia Untold and searched through Virginia Untold. And that's going to be a very valuable resource, because what we have seen through these registers is that free blacks tended to move and migrate from one place to another. So if they had a free registration, if they were registered in, say, in the city of Richmond, and they moved to, say, Lynchburg, then they would have to go to the courthouse and register in Lynchburg. They would give their Richmond City register to the Lynchburg clerk in exchange for a Lynchburg registration. And so you can see a lot of the migration patterns of free blacks during the antebellum period through these registers. The other aspect of this grant is that a project manager is going to be examining the city of Richmond court records from 1782 to 1860, examining the records and identifying records that will go into Virginia Untold, like petitions to remain in the Commonwealth, freedom suits, registrations, criminal cases. There are lots and lots of criminal cases involving enslaved and free persons that tie into, again, those records tie into records that are found in the state collection, such as the public claims. And so she's going to be going through those records, about 250 boxes. They're all unprocessed. They've never been opened. She's been doing this for 2 weeks now, and she's already have found a tremendous amount of records. So she's going to be doing that. They're going to get processed, indexed, and scanned as well, made available on transcribe for the transcription process, and then eventually make their way into Virginia Untold. One of the reasons why we're doing the city of Richmond is because there are no registers, free Negro registers, for the city of Richmond. They don't exist. And so the only way to identify who those people are is by going through these original bundles of records and doing that.
One thing I would like to add is that, just a quick note, as Greg pointed out, the project he's talking about, funded by NHPRC, which is, of course, a part of the National Archives, correct, Greg? And the United States newspaper program that ran our project for many years was funded by the National Endowment for the Humanities. And now that we're in the digital age, and the newspaper project is part of the National Digital Newspaper Program, and that's funded in large part also by the National Endowment for the Humanities. Just want anybody who's using these resources, say Virginia Chronicle or the databases that you may see coming out of NHPRC. A lot of that's funded by national organizations, and they see the value in this type of work. So just wanted to point that out, because I think it's, we have to be, we're thankful for that participation. It's also allowed the Library of Virginia to mature and develop its own infrastructure to carry out the work on its own, on our own dime. But that kind of seed money and education really helped us. I mean, a lot of this stuff seems like it's a Google box and people just jump in and they go to town and they don't see what's going on behind the so-called curtain and how much human work is involved and how much technology is at work.
And I want to also add that other institutions have seen the value of Virginia Untold. Recently, you may be aware of enslaved.org. It's a Michigan State, and other universities are collaborating on creating a national database or way of searching for enslaved and free Black history. And they recently received an NEH grant and as a part of that grant, the Library of Virginia is collaborating with enslaved.org to make data and information found in Virginia Untold available through enslaved.org. So it's going to take Virginia Untold from a state level to perhaps a national level through enslaved.org. And so we were very grateful for people who are heading up enslaved.org to contact us to see if we would want to be a part of it. We very much want to be a part of it.
That's great. Yeah, I am familiar with enslaved.org, and I'm a graduate or alum of Michigan State University, so I'm a Spartan, so definitely.
Oh, yes. I forgot that.
Yeah, so I'm definitely, like to see what's going on there. You guys make a good point, or made some great points, especially Earl, when you talked about what goes on behind the curtain, right? All the work you guys do, what you've done so far, especially with Virginia Untold, and now just having your first project manager, which I was shocked by that, and kind of, what the staff has been doing. This question is for both of you. Sort of, what are some of the underutilized online records at the Library of Virginia? And I'll start with you, Earl. Where can researchers go, or family historians go, or genealogists go to get information about their family, but they may not know about these records, or these records may not have as much visibility as some of the projects we've discussed?
There are a couple of collections, online collections that people don't know about, but would be beneficial. One is a digital collection called the Lost Records Localities. That's pretty much people who do genealogy or have a history of Virginia know. A lot of courthouses went up in flames during the history of Virginia for one reason or another. There with multiple wars and so forth. There's, for example, the Hampton, City of Hampton Courthouse was destroyed during the Revolutionary War, the War of 1812, Civil War, and a lot of records were lost, a lot of records were taken or stolen. Also, a number of courthouses experienced flooding, a lot of records were destroyed due to floods. And so, where could people go to, if the original records have been destroyed or are missing, where else could they go? In the neighboring localities, there would be court cases, and those localities didn't lose their records. And so a copy of a will from the city of Hampton could be found in a Norfolk County case, or in the case of like Buckingham County, which lost everything prior to 1892, I found a tithable list from Buckingham County dated 1782 that was found in Prince Edward County court records. The clerk in 1782 used it as a wrapper for a bundle of old records. I opened it up, and lo and behold, it's a tithable list from Buckingham County. For those who don't know a tithable list, it's basically a tax document, and it includes the names of people who lived in Buckingham County, including enslaved individuals. So we have our staff, our processing staff, we keep an eye out for those localities and see if we can, that have lost records, and see if we can find copies of their records in a collection that they're processing. And if they do, we identify those, we get them scanned, and put them in the lost records localities, digital collections. So if anybody's looking for Buckingham County or Hanover County or some of these counties lost records, they can go to this collection and maybe probably find a will, deeds, and so forth. So that's one collection. The other one is a state government collection called the Legislative Petitions. Legislative petitions are from the mid-1700s all the way up to 1863. People in Virginia could petition for just about anything to the General Assembly. In fact, up until 1842, if you wanted a divorce in Virginia, you had to petition the General Assembly. And the General Assembly would vote on whether or not to give a divorce. But also, there were petitions in regards to naturalization, in regards to, in the case of enslaved people, in the case of people, free blacks, they could petition the General Assembly to remain in the Commonwealth. And these petitions are found in the state records collection. They were not destroyed in those localities that I mentioned earlier. They survived. They have ancestors in Virginia who lived in King William County or Hanover, King and Queen, or so forth. They should look at this legislative petitions collection because there would be a large run of records related to those localities that might have their ancestors in them. So those are a couple of them that I would mention.
Yeah, the reason why I hesitated is I was trying to think of really Virginia related, like in our collections. And I'm sure a lot of your listeners know about certain resources, but I do wanted to point out the ProQuest Historical Newspapers that has a Black History collection. I thought that that's and one of the reasons I believe is because it has the New Journal and Guide out of Norfolk. And that was my regret that we weren't able to include that in our collections because that's a Virginia newspaper, but ProQuest got to it first. I think it's a valuable 20th century resource. And I might add, this is what I'll call a teaser, and that is we're looking to digitize a Richmond more recent newspaper, African-American newspaper that we would want to we're just looking into digitizing a paper that's I'm not even sure it's available on microfilm. So if we can get that out there, I don't know if it's going to be as much use for deep genealogists because it's a paper of the last 30, 40 years. But I just thought it was a valuable resource. And any story like that is worth getting online and getting out to the public because there may be something there for somebody to use. But one of the things I want to add is how all of this stuff dovetails together. Greg comes to me and says, I've got this court case, and he finds this fabulous, fascinating court case involving a case. It could be, Greg can give you the details, whether it's a case of murder or a freedom suit. But then you go to the newspaper, and the newspaper is actually covering that court case. So then they'll do it in more elaborate detail, or it'll give it a certain literary flair. And so you put the two things together and you have a more complete story. And that's when it just becomes fascinating that you've just put together, and Greg does this probably on a daily basis, but by using the archival records at the Library of Virginia, plus the newspapers, and you just cobble it together, and all of a sudden, it just blossoms into this larger story, and you get a better feel for that person's story. And if it's an enslaved individual, I know now more about that person than people know about me, 100 years from now. It's amazing. So there's all this potential energy out there that just sits there waiting for somebody to come along and discover it.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. You have kind of brought it all home and together because, as Greg was saying earlier about storytelling and the stories of opening those drawers and kind of these individuals that have been waiting for someone to discover them. And genealogy is really more than just names, dates, and places. I say that all the time. It is really about telling that person's story, especially the story of enslaved individuals or your enslaved ancestors or free people of color as well. And I'm really glad that you guys mentioned free people of color throughout this conversation, because a lot of times, even myself, I don't, mention them. I focus so much on the enslaved that I tend to kind of get stuck in that one space, but they are just as important in the narrative of American history and African-American history and Virginia history. But I want to kind of pivot to a practical sort of question, I guess. Let's say, for example, someone's pretty new to the Library of Virginia, website and new to kind of researching their family history. We know this can be overwhelming because you guys have a lot of great information. But if I'm just starting out, where would you direct me? What tips or tricks would you give me in using the resources you guys have available?
Well, one of the things is we have on our on the homepage of our website, you'll see a category called Research Guides and Indexes. The research guides, they describe what the content of the collection. So if you want to know what a, for example, what a chancery cause is, you can go to this, go to the research guide, and it'll explain what it is and the information that you'll find in that document. So there's multiple naturalization records and other types of records. There we have what's called research guides that describe each type of record. It tells you, you know, what information you will you'll find in those. We also have a catalog. We also catalog our collections, so you can do a keyword search, say of what you want to do research, or if there's a locality you want to search, you put in that locality name, and see what records you, that are available at the Library of Virginia. So that's what I think. You know, I would encourage people, just don't come out of the blue, just show up at the Library of Virginia, you know, unprepared. Do your do some homework before you come. Check the catalog records out. We also have finding aids available on a site called vaheritage.org. It's vaheritage.org. And that's that website is, we have a, it's a collaboration of multiple institutions in Virginia who have put up finding aids describing the collections in our holdings, whether it's here at the Library of Virginia or at UVA or William and Mary, George Mason, wherever else. They all, we have about 20 institutions, 20 plus institutions, the finding aids up there. So that's another a place to do your research and do your homework. We also have written blogs. We have a blog called The Uncommon Wealth, and you can do some keyword searching there to see if there's blog stories related to your family history or locality you want to do research on or type of records. And also we have social media sites. We have a YouTube channel site. On the YouTube channel site, there are a lot of how-to videos that are found on there about doing research at the Library of Virginia. Everything from getting a library card to talking about a collection of records that are available for research. There are videos on there about Virginia Untold that are available on the YouTube site about more of the how-to in regards to researching Virginia Untold.
I would like to wrap up real quick with a question around the library. Is it open today for patrons?
Yes, the Library of Virginia is open. It's open up until recently. It was open by appointment, and it was open with the provision of mask wearing. But as you know, mask wearing and all those things are subject to change, like right now as we speak here in mid May. So
I believe we're still open by appointment. We're not open to the general public. Like, you still need to make an appointment. So we have a decision on when we're going to open up to the general public has not been made yet. I know the governor is going to open up the guidelines a little bit more May 28th. And I think after May 28th, some decision will be made about opening up to the general public. But for now, we're still open by appointment.
Great. Well, I think as we continue to go through this situation, I think it changes every day for a lot of folks as we stagger and how we're opening up across the country. But I really appreciate you guys coming on to Conversations with Kenyatta. This has been very fascinating. I think with every collection that you have, we could have hours conversations about each collection, about how to use records, how to analyze those records. So I'll probably have you guys back if you would love to join me as you continue to do other things. Or do you have a closing thought?
Well, I just wanted to say, I think the great hope, as you were saying, is to have this sort of pan-searchable database where we're not in these silos. And I think this is the great hope of projects like enslaved.org or Freedom's Loom. You know, the idea is that we can technologically interweave this spaghetti of databases and bring them together so that you can do a universal search. I don't know when that's going to happen. I think conceptually it's doable, but the devil is in the details, and I'll be interested to see what happens in the coming months as people try to solve that very problem that you're talking about.
Great. Well, thanks so much. Thanks for coming to Conversations with Kenyatta.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Conversations with Kenyatta is produced by Kenyatta D. Berry and Caitlin Owl and features Kenyatta D. Berry. The music for this episode was Good Vibe by Ketza. Follow Kenyatta on Instagram under the handle kenyatta.berry, on Facebook at facebook.com/kenyattadb, and on Twitter at kenyattadb. You can also find more information on her book and upcoming events on her website at kenyattaberry.com.